So we are holding on. Oh, good morning, Ellie. Okay, so we are holding on Nun Gimel Amud Aleph. Holding on Nun Gimel Amud Aleph, five lines from the end of the narrow lines. The line begins Es Kol Ha'olam. We're in the middle of, the Mishnah had begun with the words Ketzed Ma'abrin Asa'arim, how do we enlarge the boundaries of a city in, as far as Tchumen are concerned. We said that basically what we do is we look at, if there are houses or other such things that stick out of the city, so you have most of the city is built up and then you have at one corner, let's say, you have a house that sticks out, then what we do is we draw the line on that side of the city to include that house along that entire side, so that it comes out that we're including a certain amount of area which is not actually built up, and counting that as part of the city and then measuring the tchum from outside of that. So we said in the Gemara that there are two ways of reading the word ma'abrin, the second word of the Mishnah. Is it ma'abrin as we have it with an ayin, which in that case it's related to the word isha ubra, a pregnant woman, just like she's enlarged more than usual, so is the city. Or is it ma'abrin with an aleph, meloshen aver, as in like you're adding limbs to the city. So we mentioned that Rav and Shmuel argue about that. We said one says ma'abrin with an ayin, the other one says ma'abrin with an aleph. The way we have it in the Gemara over here, it's not clear which one says which. The Yerushalmi spells it out that Rav holds ma'abrin with an aleph and Shmuel holds ma'abrin with an ayin. Anyway, that led us to a couple of other things in Torah where we find that Rav and Shmuel argue about the meaning of a certain word. We talked about the Ma'aretz Machpelah. Why is it called that? Is it that you have two rooms, one within the other, as shown in Rashi over here? Or is it that you have one room, one cave on top of the other? As far as when the Pasuk mentions Vayhi B'me'am Raphael, and we know that that was Nimrod, what was his real name Nimrod, and what was his real name Nimrod, and Amraphel was a nickname, or vice versa, is Amraphel his real name, and Nimrod a nickname. So here's another one. The Gemara says, Vayokam Melech Chodesh al Mitzrayim. The Pasuk says that a new king rose up over Mitzrayim, and he started, and then yeah, as the Pasuk says, Asher lo yoda es Yosef, he didn't know Yosef, and he started oppressing the Jewish people. So Rabbi Shmuel, Chad Omo Chodesh Mamish, one says it means literally a new king, which according to that, Ben Yehoyada says it may also mean a new king in the sense like somebody, not even a crown prince, like the son or relative or whatever of the previous king, but rather somebody from a completely new family. The other one says, no, it doesn't mean Bechlal, a new king. It means it was the same old king, but he started making new gzeiros against the Jewish people. So, Manda Oma Chodosh Mamesh Dichtiv Chodosh. The one who says, which again, when we say Rav and Shmuel, one says this, generally, Achronim talk about, it means that Rav said the first one and Shmuel said the second one. So, Rav is the one who's saying Chodosh Mamesh. So, why Dichtiv Chodosh? The Pasuk says new. So, that implies it was a new king. Whereas the one, Shmuel, who says that it was the same old king and he just started making a new Xeris, he says, because after all, if it was really a new king, you would expect the Pasuk to have said the previous king died and the new one came to power. That's the usual way. It's written in the Psukim, whether with a Jewish king, Lahavda, with a Goyish king, that when there is actually a new one, then it says, Vayomos X, Vayimloch Y, Tachtav, or Vayimlech Y, or whatever. So like this, it doesn't say that, implies it was the same one. So the question is, if you say, like Shmuel, that it means just the same old king, but new Gzeris, what do you mean? If the Pasuk says, who didn't know Yosef, so if you say it was a new king, okay, you know, time passes, people forget about what Yosef did for the country, so therefore you could say he didn't know Yosef, but if it's the same old king, what do you mean he didn't know Yosef? The answer is Maya, Sherlo Yodas Yosef. The answer is Shmuel would answer. What does it mean? He didn't know Yosef. To have a dummy commandola Yodalele Yosef Klal. He acted as though he didn't know Yosef and didn't know how Yosef saved the whole country, because if he had acted like that, he never would have done what he did. In fact, there's a Medrash actually that says that, in fact, when Paré's advisors first come to him with the idea of oppressing and enslaving the Jewish people, he says, what are you talking about? Look what Yosef did for the country. He saved us all. How you want us to do like that to his relatives and all? The upshot is, the Medrash says, they deposed him for a couple of months. And then finally, he agreed to go along with them. And then at that point, he made himself like he didn't know what Yosef had done in order to be able to say that then, okay, these people are a danger to the country, et cetera, et cetera. We talked about yesterday at the end, there's a sicha in Chelek Tezayin where the Rebbe analyzes this and the previous machlokes in Rav and Shmuel, that they're based on an underlying idea that ties them all together, is that Rav generally goes according to the meaning of the word itself, even if it doesn't fit the context so well, and Shmuel goes more according to looking at the surrounding context. So here we see an example of that, where Rav says, look, it says Chodosh, so it has to mean a new king, whereas Shmuel is looking at the surrounding context as well. The Rebbe also talks about, in that sicha, an interesting point, that part of the machlokas of Rav and Shmuel can be what when Paray did this, when he enslaved the Jewish people, what was the worst part of his avera? Was it ben adam lamakim, or was it ben adam lachavera? Now, if we say it was the same Paray as before, we know that when Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, he honored Paray. He gave him a bracha that the Nile should always rise in his honor whenever he goes to visit it. So then you could say in that sense that maybe Ben Adam, Ben Adam Lamakim, what he did wasn't so bad. Look, I mean, he was honored by Yaakov himself, no less. So he has the right, in a certain sense, to act like an autocratic king and do whatever he wants. But then it makes it much worse, Ben Adam Lachavera, because then he was actually alive when all this happened, when Yosef was there, when Yaakov came and benched him. So what do you mean now? How is he now going and oppressing and enslaving the Jewish people? So according to Shmuel, then it would come out that the Ben Adam Lachavera part was worse, which fits with the fact that Shmuel's specialty is dinim amanus, which are ben adam lachaveri, and the halacha is usually like Shmuel in them. As opposed to if we say that it was a new king, then if we say it was a new king literally, then it's the other way around. Ben adam lachaveri, in a way, there's sort of an excuse for him. Okay, you know, he's from a later generation. He didn't know firsthand what Yosef had done for the country, so maybe you can't blame him as much. But then the Ben Adam Lamakim part of it is so much worse. You never received that bracha from Yaakov. You never were honored like that. So all of a sudden you're a new king. So what are you doing putting yourself up as a dictator like that and saying that you can do whatever you want to the Jewish people? And that would be Rav's shitta, where Rav's specialty is Isser Vehetter, is things Ben Adam Lamakim. That's the gist of what the Rebbe explains at the end of that sicha. Okay. So now we're going to go on to some other topics regarding learning Torah. A simon shmoina esrei shneim also lamanu b'david vayiven. These are a simon for b'dorei libon, is really supposed to be the last two. These are simonim. These are key words for the next few statements that the Gemara is going to bring So number one, Amar Rabbi Yechanan, yud ches yomim gidalti etzer Rav Oshia b'ribi. For 18 days I grew up with, meaning I learned by Rav Oshia Beribi. Rashi explains Beribi means the greatest one of the generation. This Rav Oshia is the one, when we know that the Tesefta was written by Rav Chia and Rav Oshia, this is the Rav Oshia we're talking about. So Rav Yechanan says, I spent 18 days growing up by him and learning in his yeshiva. V'lo lamadti mimenu ela dover echad b'mishnasenu keitzid ma'abrin esa'orim ba'alef. I only learned from him in those 18 days one thing in Mishnayos, namely in our Mishnah, where it says Ketzed Ma'abrin, that the proper way is that the proper way to read the word is Ma'abrin with an Aleph. So the Gemara says that's the connection over here that we're talking about our Mishnah. So the Gemara says, Eini, what do you mean in all those 18 days? That's all Rabbi Yechanan learned. Va'amar Rabbi Yechanan. We also find that Rabbi Yechanan said Yud Beis Tamidim Hoylo L'Rav Oshia B'Ribi. Rav Oshia B'Ribi had 12 Talmidim. The Yud Ches Yomim Gidalti Benehen. I spent 18 days growing up among them, and during that time, V'lamadti Lev Kol Echad Ve'Echad V'Chochmas Kol Echad Ve'Echad. During that time, I learned the heart of each one and the Chochma of each one. Six lines from the sixth line of the wide lines. During that time, I learned the heart of each one. Which means Rashi says how sharp he was, and how wise each one is. In other words, the lev would mean as far as charifus, how what abilities they have as far as pilpul, as far as deriving one halacha from the other, and chokhmah would mean how much they actually learned in terms of the actual facts, mishnayos and braisos, halachas, whatever. So we see he learned a lot during those 18 days. Says, okay, lev kalachad v'achad v'chachmas kalachad v'achad gamar. Sure, he didn't waste his time over there. He spent that time finding out about the lev and the chachma of every one of them. Gamara, like gamar, but not necessarily did he learn anything. Not necessarily did he learn actual new things in Torah. Another possibility, maybe Rabbi Yechinen means that during those 18 days, he learned from all of those talmidim. But during those 18 days, he only had the chance to learn one thing from Oshia himself. A third possibility is maybe Rabbi Yechinen means that I was only able to learn one thing in Mishnayos. So he learned a lot of things in Brisis, and he learned a lot of things of Gemara, which is the analysis of the Mishnayos, but in the Mishnah itself, during that time, they only learned the one thing of the proper spelling of the word Ketzer Ma'abrin. Afterwards, actually, Tosfos points out we find a Gemara in Yevamos where we find Rabbi Yochanan asking a question of Rabbi Oshia. So Tosfos says, okay, we're talking here during the first 18 days. Later on, at some later point, Rabbi Yochanan was able to learn a lot more from Rabbi Oshia. Also Rabbi Yechinen says in connection with this, so the Gemara has three answers over here. One is that during those 18 days he learned lots from Rabbi Oshia, but only in Mishnayos itself, and in the Shisha Sidri Mishnah, only one thing. A second one, according to that last answer, he learned Brisis, he learned analysis of Mishnayos and Brisis, which is the Gemara, but in Mishnayos itself he only learned one particular thing. The previous answer in the Gemara was that he learned from the Talmidim, but not from Rabbi Oshia. And the first answer in the Gemara was that he figured out the qualities of each of the Talmidim. What do they know in terms of Chochmah and in terms of Lev, but according to the first answer, not necessarily that he actually learned during those 18 days actual topics in Mishnayos or Brisis or Gemara. So those are the three answers. Rabbi Yechinen also says, when we were learning Torah by Rabbi Oshia Beribi, we would sit four people in every amma, because that's how they were so eager to hear that they'd squeeze into a very narrow space. Now you think of it, usually in the Gemara, the usual assumption is a person takes up an amma. So four people to squeeze into an amma, Marsha says, in fact, it must have been B'derech Nes, because there's no way that it could fit naturally. But, you know, I mean, those of us who remember 770 in the good old days may not find it that surprising, yeah. Amar Rebbe, and Rebbe says even more than that. What Rebbe says, in a previous generation, when we would learn Torah by Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua, Hoyunu Yoshvin Shisha Shisha ba'amma, we would sit six people in every amma. There is one possibility, one of the Achronim says, maybe the Gemara means every square amma. Maybe it doesn't mean a linear amma, maybe it means a square amma. So, okay, four people in a square amma or six people in a square amma, it's a very tight squeeze, but not quite as much meisen nissim. 770 on Shabbos versus on Simchas Torah, yeah. And so according to that, then it may not have had to be B'derech Nes, like the way the Maharsha says. Okay. Also, Rabbi Yechinen says, you should know, Rabbi Oshia Beribi, in his generation, was as great relative to the other Chachamim as Rabbi Meir was relative to the other Chachamim in his generation. Ma Rabbi Meir Bedore lo yochlo chaver of Lamed al Seif Daitoi. Now, we learned in the first perek of Or Masechta on Daf Yud Gimel that Reb Meir, his chaverim, his colleagues, could not always understand what he actually meant, because Rashi brings from the Gemara over there that he was able to find a good logical reason, even on something that's tamei, to say that it's tahor and show a good logical reason for it. So in the course of the argument about is something tamei or tahor, he would be able to bring arguments plausible sounding arguments for both sides, and his chaverim couldn't always tell which one he actually held and which one was only for purposes, for the sake of argument, in order to figure out what the actual halacha, on the way to figuring out what the actual halacha was. So therefore, so the same thing. After Rab Oshia, lo yochlo chaver of lamad al seif daite, Rab Oshia was the same thing. So the other chachamim couldn't always figure out what he actually holds la halacha, and he had to be very careful to figure out from what he's saying what he means, what he actually holds versus what he's just saying for purposes of argument to work out what the on the way to working out what the halacha is. The Amr Rabbi Yechanan, also Rabbi Yechanan says, Liban shal rishonim kepischa shal ulam, the heart, meaning the ability to understand Torah of the earlier generations, was like the entrance to the ulam. So the ulam, we learned in the first parak, was 20 amos wide and 40 amos tall. The one of the later generations, we're going to explain in a second who the earlier and the later generations are, is only like the entrance of the Heichel, which is only half as wide, 10 amos wide and 20 tall. So in width, Rashi focuses on the width over here, that the Heichel's door was half the width of the Olam. So the same way the Achronim are, the later generations only have half the ability to understand of the earlier ones. We learned in the second parak of our Masechta on Daf Chaf Aleph, we talked about the size of the size metaphorically of Torah Shabbat Peh. We talked about, based on a description that the Novi Yechezko gives and that Zechariah gives, we figured out that Zechariah sees a folded scroll that contains Torah Shabbat Peh, 10 by 20 amos folded, meaning that if you unfold it, it's 20 by 20. And then Yechezkel describes that it's written on the front and the back, meaning that the total written area is 20 by 40, 800 square amos. So Marsha explains that there's a connection over here. In other words, what we're saying is we're talking about the area of the doorway of the Olam was 20 by 40 amos, the same 800 square amos. So what it means is, in other words, the earlier, now Marsha explains over there on that Gemara, so we have four aspects of Torah corresponding to what we're familiar with, Pshat, Remez, Drush, and Sod. So the idea is the earlier generations were masters of all four of those. So like for them, the whole Torah was unfolded and in front of them, like the door of the Olam. So they were familiar with the whole, so to speak, 800 square amos of Torah Shabbat Peh, all four aspects of it. Whereas the later generations are only like the entrance of the Heichel, which is 20 by 10, meaning like for them, they only know one aspect of Torah, primarily Pshat, and not so much, and not as much the other ones. And then Rabbi Yechanan continues, as far as us, the Talmidim of those later generations, our hearts are only as open as the hole for a needle which you use to sew up rips in clothing, which of course is a very small needle. Well, you have also the connection between a needle and the door of the Olam. The other way around, the famous Medrash, where Hashem says to the Jewish people, open up for me an entrance the size of a needle, and I'll open up for you an entrance of Tshuva the size of the door of the Olam. The point is, the Maharal talks about over here, the Maharal talks about in Be'er Agola, the idea is, in other words, that in the earlier generations, their neshama was stronger than their guf. Therefore, they had the much greater ability to learn and absorb and understand Torah. Whereas by us, and as the generations go on, the guf becomes stronger relative to the body. And therefore, like the hole into which Torah can enter becomes smaller and smaller. So who are these Rishonim and who are these Achronim? Rishonim Rabbi Akiva, Achronim Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua. The earlier generations means Rabbi Akiva, the later one means Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua. And Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua is one of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim. So just in that one generation, you have this tremendous descent. One reason for it might be, Rabbi Akiva was actually alive at the time of the Churban. He wasn't yet one of the top level Chachamim, but he was already alive then and learning Torah then, whereas Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua apparently was from the generation that was born after the Churban. So that may be, that may have made a difference. Ikadamri, another version is Rishonim Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua, Achronim Rabbi Oshia Beribi. Another version is that the Rishonim means Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua, and the Achronim in this sense refers to Rabbi Oshia Beribi, the Rabbi Yechanan's Rebbe that we were just talking about before. In which case, there's two generations between them because Rabbi Lozab ben Shamua was one of Rebbe's Rebbeim, And Reb Oshia was one of Rebbe's Talmidim. So then it would mean just in those two generations, from the generation of the Mishnayos until Reb Oshia, we said, wrote the Tesefta, you had this tremendous descent. There is, by the way, it's worth mentioning in this connection, something the Rebbe writes, the Rebbe's father, Reb Levi Yitzchok, writes in a letter to him, when we talk about the Tanoim and Amoroim said the halacha is such and such, or they said such and such in Torah, they're not just basing themselves on seichel anushi, on human logic. Because if that were the case, Reb Levick says, then you would. We always say, for example, Amoroim can't argue with Tanoim, later generations can't argue with Amoroim. If it was just a matter of Seichel Anoshi, why not? Okay, yes, they were greater people. Sometimes you have a person born in a later generation who has tremendous abilities, which is a throwback to earlier generations. For example, they said about the Alter Rebbe that he would have been a Tana if he had been in the time of the Tanoim. And yet we know that the Alter Rebbe can't argue with the Tanoim. Why is that? Because in terms of Seichel, maybe he might have been as great as them, but in terms of the ability to be able to look in the Olam HaSel Yonim and see what should the halacha be, or what is the Pnimis Inyonim of this thing, they had that ability and the later generations don't. That's also included in what we're saying over here about the Rishonim versus the Achronim in terms of amount of knowledge of Torah. How would it have been with David HaMelech? We don't know. It would have been even more. It's also possible. I mean, it's also possible. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the Tanoim in principle can argue with any earlier with any earlier authorities. I mean, they're not going to argue. Yeah, we hardly even know any halachos that's true. Anyway, right? But yeah. But it could be that maybe the vote is you have the understanding of the people who lived up to and including the time of Churban Bayis Sheni versus afterwards. Maybe that's why the Gemara mentions Rabbi Akiva, because his generation is the last one that still saw the second Beis Hamikdash. Could be. Anyway. Amar Abayas says, let's continue how the progression went after the Oshia Beribi. Va'anan, as far as us in our generation, kisikta beguda l'gemara. As far as learning Gemara, as far as learning the actual facts of Mishnayos and Braises and Halachas and whatever, it's like trying to put a peg into a narrow hole in the wall. You have to hammer it in. It doesn't go in that easily. That's how hard it is. Like we only understand a little bit of what we hear in Torah, and with great difficulty. And this is even before the Gemara was finished, right? Yeah, Amar Rava v'anan ki etzba'osa b'kira l'svara. Rava says, and as far as svara, which is again where you take the facts that you were given and use it to derive new halachas and new information, we're like a finger trying to go into wax. Meaning, Rashi describes the wax is stiff; you can't easily get your finger in there. You press your finger on it, and a tiny bit of the wax sticks to your finger. So the same way, we have a very hard time coming up with svaras in Torah. And the Maharal and a couple of other Achronim talk about an idea why the comparison to wax is wax. On the other hand, I mean, it's hard when it's cold, but it's also easily moldable into any shape. The same way, like we have nowadays, our svaras, we can come up with a svara this way, we can come up with a svara that way, and there's never any way to tell which one is the correct svara. Unlike, in other words, Reb Oshia Beribi, where we're saying he comes up with svaras on different sides of the issue, when he knows which one is his actual svara versus which one he's only doing for argument's sake in the course of deriving the halacha, we can come up with svaras in both directions, and we have no easy way of determining which one is the correct svara and which one is not. That's the comparison to wax. Amar Rav Ashi, anan ki etzba osa bebeira l'shikha. And Rav Ashi says, as far as forgetting Torah, it's like sticking a finger into a pit in the ground, and there's no problem sticking it in because the pit is much wider than your finger. That's how easy it is for us to forget the Torah that we learn. Tosfos brings a different girsa, not bebeira, but bebizra, which means seeds. If you have, let's say, a pile of seeds, let's say mustard seeds, if you stick your finger in, you'll make a hole in there, you'll make a depression in there, but you take out your finger and all the seeds fall right back in as if there was never any hole there. The same way, like we finish one masechta and we start the next one, and we've already forgotten the first one that we learned. More about learning Torah and about the proper way to go about it. Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, B'nai Yehuda shikpidu. Well, this, it's also going to relate to our Mishnah. B'nai Yehuda shikpidu al lashonim. The people of Yehuda, of the southern part of Eretz Yisrael, who were careful with their lashon, as we're going to see examples on Amud Beis. So they were careful with their lashon. Niskaima torasin biyadam. So therefore, their Torah was preserved with them. They were able to remember it better. Rashi mentions what it means. Hikpidu al lashonim means, Rashi says, that they would speak in very clear language. They wouldn't. We're going to see on Amud Beis examples where Bnei Yehuda would speak. Would clearly delineate what they're trying to say, in order to make it so everybody should understand it. Whereas B'nai Galil were more careless in their speech, in their pronunciation, in their speech habits and whatever. B'nai Yehuda lived in the southern part of Eretz Yisrael, the area of Yerushalayim, Lud, but yeah. As opposed to the Galil, right? B'nai Galil shalek pidur al lashonim, as opposed to the people of Galil, who were not as careful with their lashon, with their pronunciation, with their words or whatever. Therefore, lo neskaima torasim biyadam. So their Torah was not preserved by them, and they tended to forget it more. So Gemara says, what do you mean? Yeah, it's very, it's fast or whatever. Now, that's true. And not necessarily are we talking about, when we say B'nai Yehuda and B'nai Galil, we could be talking about just the fact that they had to move north, just the fact that you have certain areas, al-derech, like we have in the Gemara, avira de Eretz Yisrael machim, that the air of Eretz Yisrael itself makes a person wise. So it could be the actual being in Yehuda versus being in Galil makes a difference. Or it could be, we may mean B'nai Yehuda as in originally, the Chachamim who lived in Yehuda versus the Chachamim who originally came from Galil. Eventually, all of them were forced to move to Galil, so then you didn't necessarily have this distinction anymore. It could also be, you know, when we're talking about the distinction between we said that the descent we had from Rabbi Akiva to Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua might also be related to this. Rabbi Akiva was still of the generation where he lived most of his life in Eretz Yehuda. He was the Rav in Rosh Hashiva in Bnei Brak, for example, which is in the south of Eretz Yisrael. Later on, the Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua already is already from the generation that mostly is based in the Galil, because the Romans forced them out of most of Yehuda. Yeah, yeah. So it could be that also. So the Gemara says, though, midi b'kpeda talya milsa. What do you mean? Since when does being able to remember Torah or not depend on how careful you are with your speech? Ella, no, you're right. What we mean is like this. B'nai Yehuda de daiki lishna. What we mean is the connection is like this. The B'nai Yehuda were very precise with their loshen. They would review it in the exact loshen that they heard from their Rebbe. U'matnechi lehu simona. And they were able to make simonim for what they learned, because when they're always learning it in the same lashon and they're careful to repeat this, the exact same lashon that they heard from their rabbeim, it becomes much easier to make simonim for it, like we had before in the Gemara, the list of keywords that help you remember what you learned. So therefore, niskaima torasim biyadan. So therefore, the Torah was preserved by them because they were careful to always use the same lashon, and that helped keep it straight in their head. B'nai Galil deloy daiki lishna, as opposed to the people of the Galil, were not so precise with the lashon. So like they would learn from many different rebbeim, that each rebbe had a different way of expressing the same ideas, so they're not necessarily saying it in the same lashon. Actually, that's the next thing, really, is mechad rabba versus mechad rabba. Okay, so deloy daiki lishna, the people of the Galil, because they're careless with their speech habits, the result is that when they're learning, they're not careful to always use the same lashon each time. Veloy matnechi lahu simana, so they're not able to make simonim to easily remember what they learn, because each time they're learning with a different lashon. Therefore, lo niskaima torasim biyadam. Therefore, their Torah was not as well preserved by them because they weren't able to make simonim for it. We learned in Masechet Shabbos that when you have an aleph bays, you have samach and then ayin. One meaning of it is simonim aseba Torah kneyosi. You have to make simonim. You have to make mnemonics for yourself in Torah, and that's how you'll acquire and retain the Torah. So the B'nai Galil were not able to do that. We have a lot of them in the Gemara, yeah.
That's the part that everyone always ignores until they realize what it is.
Yeah. Mind you, by the way, there is a sefer from Reb David Pardo, one of the big Sfardish Achronim. I think he was the Rav of Istanbul, I think, or something. I don't remember, whatever. He was a big Rav in the 1700s. He wrote a bunch of Sfarim. One of them, in the back of one of his Sfarim, he goes through all the Simonim and Shas and explains a deeper meaning behind each one of them. So we've quoted him. I've quoted him a few times when I didn't look him up in connection with the simon that we had earlier on the Amud, Simon Shmoinas or whatever. But he has a vote for each of these simonim, the deeper meaning of why the Gemara used it. Okay. Anyway, another one, the Gemara says, Bnei Yehuda Gomru Mechad Rabba. Another advantage the Bnei Yehuda had was they would learn from only one Rebbe. So therefore, so the point is, the Rebbe each time, so he uses the same lashon. So again, that way it helps fix it in their minds better. Therefore Niskaima Teras and Miyadon. So therefore, their Torah was preserved by them. Bnei Galil Deloy Gamri Mechad Rabba, as opposed to the people of the Galil, would learn from many different Rebbeim. So each Rebbe, again, has his different style of teaching and his different style of speaking. So therefore, it would end up getting confusing, and they would end up more easily forgetting what they learned. Tosfos points out there's a difference between this connection between Gemara and Svara. We said before, Gemara means learning the basic facts, the Mishnayos, the Braisos, the Halachos, whatever, versus Svara means coming up with your own Svaras to derive Halachos, to derive new Halachos from what you learned, etc. So Tosfos points out, when it comes to Svara, Adraba, don't just learn from one Rebbe. If you do, you have a Gemara and a Avodah Zarah that says you won't see a Simin Bracha. So when it comes to Svara, you have to learn from different Rebbeim because each one has their own different way of learning Svara. But when it comes to Gemara, better to stick with one Rebbe, as the Gemara is saying over here. So in the Bnei Galil, learn the Skama Taras and the Yom. Ravina says, here's another distinction. Bnei Yehuda de Galu Masechta, the people of Yehuda were Galu Masechta, and therefore, I'll explain in a second what that means. Therefore, Niskaima Teras and Miyadam, therefore their Torah was preserved by them. Rashi says that Rashi has two explanations. One is it means they didn't just learn for themselves, they taught others, and we always know that teaching other people helps fix it better in your brain. That's one. Rashi says the second explanation was that they would explain very clearly what they're saying. So this way, like they're not just reading off the words, they're explaining it in detail. And again, that helps fix it in their minds better. A couple of other explanations, the Meiri and also Rabbi Yaakov Emden say it means before they would give a shiur, they would announce in advance what the topic is and what the Mar Mekoimus or whatever. Like you have nowadays, sometimes, you know, you have, for example, when, let's say, you give handouts, like when Beryl Levin gives his shiurim, for example, he has his handouts ahead of time of what the topic is, so that this way, the people who are listening can research, they can look up the things for themselves, find good questions to ask, etc. So that's another meaning of it. And Marsha says a fourth one, Galu Masechta, means they would learn in such a way that they actually arrive at what the correct halacha is. It's called. So anyways, therefore, Niskaima Teras and the Yadam. So because they had these advantages, therefore their Torah was preserved and they remembered it. Bnei Galil, Deloy Galu Masechta, as opposed to the Bnei Galil, did not do that, therefore Niskaima Teras and the Yadam. Here's another example of the contrast between two people as far as this. David Gali Masechta, David would do this when he was teaching Torah, he would, the various explanations, not just learn it for himself, but teach it to others, explain it very well, give out handouts ahead of time so people know what he's going to be teaching about, work to figure out what the actual halacha is. And Shol, like Gali Masechta, as opposed to Shol, was not like that. He didn't teach other people, or he didn't explain clearly, or he didn't give handouts, etc. David de Gali Masechta, David had that advantage, and therefore the Pasuk says, Ksivbe, Yire Echo Yiruni V'yismachu, those who fear you, Hashem, will see me, and they will be happy. Meaning because what he teaches is very precise. So whatever David says, if David says that something is osur, then you know it's osur. You can take it to the bank. And the same thing if he says that something is mutter. So the Talmid Chachamim, those who fear Hashem, see me and they learn from me and they're happy because they know they're able to reach the correct conclusion in halacha. Shol de Legali Masechta, Rashi brings over here from Gemara's in Brochas and Moed Cotton that David didn't just teach halacha, he actually paskened halacha in practice. We learn in Brochas, it mentions over there that women would bring him their shilas of damnida and miscarriages or whatever, and he'd personally look them over, even though it makes his hands filthy and all. Shol de Legali Masechta, on the other hand, Shol was not Gali Masechta in this sense. Therefore, Ksiv Bey, you have a posik about him that says, El Kol Asher Yifteh Yarshia. Wherever he would go, Yahushua. Now, the simple meaning, the Mephoshim on the Pasuk explains that in context, the Pasuk is talking about how he fought against the various enemies of the Jewish people, and Yahushua, like he made them confused, he made them frightened, or whatever. The word Rasha, sometimes the word Rasha doesn't always mean a Rasha as in a wicked person. Sometimes it means like a person who's nervous and jittery and whatever. In fact, for example, the Meiri explains that on the first Pasuk in Tehillim, when we say Ashrei Ish Asher Lahalach Ba'atzas Rishoyim, he says it doesn't mean Rishoyim as in the simple sense. It means people who are nervous and jittery and they're always in a hurry to go and earn money and whatever, like better a person who doesn't consider that his main focus in life. Pasuk is telling us. Anyway, but so that we see the word Rasha can mean like nervous and jittery and whatever. What we see, in other words, the Gemara is darshining over here, Meloshin, sort of Meloshin Rasha, as in the sense that he wasn't able to arrive at the correct conclusion in Halacha. And that's a result, again, that he wasn't Gali Masechta. Okay, since we're talking about Shoal, V'omer Rabbi Yechanan, Minayin Shemachalai HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al Oisei Oven, how do we know that Hashem forgave him for that Aveira, that we know that he wiped out, at his command, Noiv Ir HaKoinim was wiped out? How do we know that in the end Hashem forgave him for that? So that Rashi says over here it means that. One, a couple of other Mephoshim talk about maybe other possibilities. Maybe it means the fact that he didn't wipe out Amalek. Maybe it means the fact that now he went to the witch over there, to the Eishes Baal HaSoiv, to bring up Shmuel's spirit, whatever. Anyway, how do we know Hashem forgave him for it? Tomorrow, Shmuel tells him, you and your sons will be with me, meaning this is after Shmuel had passed away, and he goes to the Eishes Baal HaSoiv, the famous story of Shoal and the witch. And he has her bring up Shmuel's spirit. And then Shmuel tells him that tomorrow you're going to be fighting against the Plishtim, and you and your sons are going to be killed. Umachar ato vanecha imi, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me, which means imi bimchitzasi, together with me in my mechitze in Gan Eden. So if Hashem hadn't forgiven him for the Aveira, then he wouldn't be able to be in Shmuel's mechitze. So that shows that Hashem forgave him. Some of the Mephoshim explain the connection with what we just said. We just said that Shaul was not able to reach the correct conclusion in Halacha. So does that mean he was actually over on Averis? So the Gemara is stressing over here that no, Hashem forgave him for that because he was trying to get to the right conclusion even if he didn't have the Siyata Dishmaya to accomplish that. So we said that one thing is he wasn't Gali Masechta. According to these various explanations, he didn't teach Talmidim, he didn't explain himself as clearly as he should, he didn't pre-announce what the topic is in order that people should ask good shailas, whatever. Okay. Getting back now so now how does this thing of Yehuda, of the precision of the people of Yehuda, first of all, how does it connect with our Mishnah? And then we're going to have some examples. So Amar Abba, I Ika Demashalahu L'Bnei Yehuda. So Rabbi Abba says, is there anybody available who can ask the Bnei Yehuda, the Daiki Lishna, who, as we said, are precise with their wording, and ask them about our Mishnah, ma'abrin tnan with an aleph or ma'abrin tnan with an ayin? What is the proper word in our Mishnah? Is it ma'abrin with an aleph or ma'abrin with an ayin? Again, we can't ask the people of Galil. They're too careless with their speech, as we're going to see soon, that they don't pronounce aleph and ayin distinctly enough to be able for us to be able to tell. But the Bnei Yehuda are precise with that. So is there anybody available? Can ask them. Also, a similar thing, akuzaitnan oi akuzaitnan. You have a Mishnah in Bechoris that describes a case. You have an animal, a Bechor. It has only one testicle. So then that would be considered a balmum. But Rabbi Akiva says, not necessarily is that a given. You could have that it has the second one and it's just stuck inside the body. It didn't descend. So what you do, Rabbi Akiva says, is you have the animal sit on akuzo, which means its backside, and you squeeze and then you squeeze and massage and manipulate over there and see whether you can get the other testicle to descend. And then if it does, then it's not a baal mum. The point is the Mishnah uses the word akuzo. This is a bechor we're talking about. So the point is the Mishnah uses the word over there, the word akuzai. So Rabbi Abba says the same thing. We should see if there anybody can ask the Bnei Yehuda and find, remember that would mean traveling to Yehuda, which wasn't necessarily an easy thing in those days, but and find out what is the right word. Is it supposed to be akuzai with an aleph or akuzai with an ayin? So the Gemara, so the Gemara says Yadi. So in fact they knew She'ilin, who, so they did end up asking the Bnei Yehuda, but Amrile, and they answered as follows. Both of them are right. As a matter of fact, you have people who learn it both ways. As we said at the beginning of the sugya, Rav and Shmuel argue about ma'abrin, whether it's supposed to be with an aleph or an ayin. So in fact, the Bnei Yehuda says both of them are correct. Some Talmud Chachamim learn it one way and some learn it the other way. Okay. Next, so we said Bnei Yehuda didaiki lishna. We said on Amud Aleph that the Bnei Yehuda were very precise with their wording. They were very careful to say things in a way that people would clearly understand what they mean. Maihi. So what's an example of that? So an example is Dahu Bar Yehuda de Omalu Talis Yeshli Limker. A person from Yehuda one time announces, "I have a talis to sell." So they ask him, what color is this talis? So he answers them, kitrodin ale adama, like trodin, which are beets on the ground. Meaning, in other words, like when beets grow in the ground, and the beets themselves are red, but you have their leaves are green, and their leaves lie on top of the ground. So the reason why he said it that way, Marsha explains, because the usual word for it would be yoroik. The problem is the word yoroik in Gemara terminology means a few different shades of color. It can mean green, like it does in modern Hebrew, but it can also mean yellow. Sometimes even there's a Tosfos in Sukkah that talks about it may even mean blue. So if he said yoroik, then it wouldn't be clear what color it was. So instead he uses this expression, ketrodin alei adama, so that it's clear to everybody what he means. He means the color of beet leaves as they grow on the ground. And that way it's unequivocal what he means. So that's an example of the daiki lishna, where he uses a very precise lashon to express exactly what he wants to say. On the other hand, Bnei Galil deloy daiki lishna maihi. What's an example of the people of the Galil who were not careful with their lashon? So like this, Tanya, okay, maybe it's not a brisa. Dahu ba Galila dahava ka'azil. There was a certain person from Galil who was walking along, v'omalahu, and he's asking a question. Amar laman, amar laman. Who has an amar? Who has an amar to sell or to give or whatever? Now, what is Amar? Omrulay. So they said to him, Glila Shoita, you foolish person from Galil. What do you mean? Now, he wasn't pronouncing, the problem was that he wasn't pronouncing the first consonant clearly, so they weren't clear whether it's supposed to be an Aleph or a Ches or an Ayin. Now, for us Ashkenazim, of course, a Ches would sound completely different, but, you know, Sfardim pronounce a Ches gutturally in the throat. So for them, an Aleph and an Ayin and a Ches have a certain similarity to that. They're all letters produced in the back of the throat, so they weren't clear what he meant. So what do you mean? Chamar lemirkav? Do you mean you want a donkey to ride on? Oy chamar lemishti? Or you're looking for wine to drink? Amar lemilbash? Or you're looking with an ayin for wool to be able to use for clothing? Oy imar leiskasa? Or maybe you do after all mean with an aleph and you mean a sheep to shecht and eat. So like this, he didn't enunciate his words clearly enough for them to be able to understand. That's an example of what we mean, that they weren't medayik in their lashon. And therefore, we said on Amud Aleph, because of that, they had a harder time learning and remembering Torah because they weren't so clear about the words that they used. Well, so they called him a shoita for that, because like he's wasting his words, like say it clearly to begin with so everybody understands what you mean. Another example, or a couple of other examples of people from the Galil who pronounced their words very indistinctly and ended up saying the wrong thing. Hahi itza de boi lemeim alachavata toi de oichle chelva. There was a woman who one time wanted to say to her friend, "Come and I'll give you some milk to eat or to drink." But again, she didn't pronounce the words clearly. She slurred the words together also. Omrullah. So in the end, she ended up saying shluchti. She meant to say shluvti, which means my friend. Instead, she said shluchti with a chaf, which is a meaningless word. And toich lech lavi. And when she wanted to say toid oich lech chelba, again, by slurring the words together, she said toich lech lavi, a lion should eat you up. Another example, a certain woman once came in front of a dayan with a complaint that she needed a din Torah, omrele. And as she's describing the case to the dayan, she makes a bunch of mistakes. Again, the same idea. She was from the Galil, and she made a bunch of mistakes in her speech that make some of the words that she's saying mean the opposite of or meaning meaningless things compared to what she was trying to say. Omrala, she says, Mori Kiri, with a chof. She said, Mori means my master. Kiri, she meant to say Kiri with a kuf, which also means my master. It comes from a Greek word. Instead, she used the word Kiri with a chof, which means my slave. So Mori Kiri, she's saying my master, my slave. Tafla, obviously, I had a tafla. Rashi explains she meant to say tavla, which means a board, and instead she mispronounces it as tafla, which means a beam. Ugnavuch min, and she meant to say they stole it from me, but instead she says ugnavucha, instead of saying veganvuha mini or something like that, instead she said ugnavuch min, which means and they stole you from me. So v'uchadu havas, and she continues, and it was like this. She meant to say the next word was supposed to be not uchadu but uchadain, meaning this is what it was, meaning this is the size of it. Instead, the word uchadu means and now. So uchadu havas, and now it was, which doesn't mean anything. She meant to say uchadain havas, it was this size. How big was it? If they were to hang you on it, your feet wouldn't touch the ground. In other words, it's taller than you are. But that's a foolish way of saying it. You don't talk to a rav, a dayan like that, and talk about you being hanged. So we see, in other words, that she was careless, number one, with her pronunciation. And with her words that she's used, so she's making mistakes in pronunciation. One word that ends up sounding like a different word, like tavla becoming tafla, using the wrong words, like using kiri with a chaf instead of kiri with a kaf, and also not thinking what she's saying and saying something silly, like if they were to hang you, like if they were to hang you. So these are all examples of this that we're saying that the Bnei Galil were not particular with their lashon. So now, as a contrast, it could be because they had an accent, but it could be, the Gemara seems to be saying that it's not just a matter of that was their natural accent. It seems the Gemara is saying that they were being careless in that they could have enunciated it better and they weren't. Right. So when a difference in pronunciation develops over time, but still, I mean, we might well say that in that sense. I mean, you know, if we contrast nowadays Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, for example, so we Ashkenazim are more careless with the consonants. There are a bunch of them that we pronounce similar when really they should be different, like ches and chof and whatever. On the other hand, the Sfaradim are less careful when it comes to the Nekudas. They pronounce Kometz and Patach, well, Kometz Gadol and Patach the same. They pronounce Seira and Segel the same. And the Temanim are careful with everything. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to give as a contrast to that examples where we find that people would speak beloshen chokhma, where they're using words that they're davka trying to hide the meaning of what they're saying in order not to embarrass people or in order not to give people information that they don't want them to give other people information that they don't want to not allow outsiders, in other words, to know what they're saying, etc. So this is called Lashon Chochma. So the Gemara gives a few examples of it. Amhosa de Bei Rebbe, the maidservant in the house of Rebbe, ki have a mishtoya b'loshen chachma, when she wanted to speak in Loshen Chachma. So now you have the situation is you have Talmidim who are in Rebbe's house and are eating and drinking over there. So now the question is it time to finish the meal and everybody should go home, or is it time to continue the meal? Now, she being the maidservant, she doesn't want to tell them openly that it's time to go or it's time to stay. It's like she's not on their level. They're the Talmidim of Rebbe and she's only the maidservant. So she would use Loshen Chochma for that purpose. So she says, Omra Hochi, so she would say like this, Olas nakfas bekad, the dipper or the ladle is striking against the barrel. meaning, in other words, the barrel of wine is empty, and like the ladle or whatever, the dipper or whatever that we use to get wine out of it is already banging against the bottom because it's empty of wine. So the eagles, meaning the chachamim, should fly to their nests, meaning it's time to finish up the meal and go home. And on the other hand, if she intended that they should stay, then have a amr lahu, then she would use a different lashon chachma. She would say, "Yedi boser chaverta mina." We will remove the magufa, the stopper of another barrel after it. Boser means after. Another possibility is boser can also mean a piece, like you remove a piece of the magufa in order to get out wine. And Marsha says maybe the right word is not boser, but keser, meaning the crown, because the stopper at the top of the barrel is like a crown on top of the head. Anyway, we'll take off another one. The tiskefe olas bekad, and the ladle will float in the barrel, ki'ilfa de ozlabayama, like a ship that sails in the sea. So the way we have it in the Gemara over here, it sounds like she's the one making the decision whether, are we going to open another barrel of wine and continue serving, or are we going to say, it's fine, you know, we're done with this barrel, it's time to go home. Some of the Mefarshim explain, they have a slightly different girsa, and they say it's not that she would make the decision themselves, but rather what it is, Marsha, for example, says this, others, that what it is she would use the Lashon Chachma to ask Rebbe. She would say, the ladle is banging against the jar, is it time to close up shop and everybody should go home? Sometimes he would say, yes, Yidun Shraya Lakineha, and the eagles should fly home. And sometimes he would say, Yedi Basa Chavatamina, I'll take off the stopper of another barrel. So in other words, the decision is up to Rebbe, and she's using Lashon Chachma to ask Rebbe, so this way the Talmidim don't realize that, look at this, you know, we're gonna end up eating Rebbe out of house and home like this. Okay. Another example. Rabbi Yossi bar Asyon kiyave mishtoi b'loshen chachma. When Rabbi Yossi bar Asyon was using loshen chachma, Omar, he would say this: he would use loshen chachma in order to order what he wants to eat. So again, the idea is he doesn't want outsiders to know; it's none of their business what he's eating. So he would use loshen chachma. He would say, Omar, he would say, Asuli shur mishpat b'tur miskin. Make for me a shur mishpat with tur miskin. Shur is it, the Aramaic word for shur is tur. Mishpat, another word for it, is din. So that results in the word trodin, which means beets or spinach or some related vegetable like that. And betur miskein, tur is the Aramaic word for a mountain, so the Hebrew word for it is har. Miskein means poor, so another word for it is dal. So that gives us the word hardol, which is similar to chardol, which means mustard. So in short, he was asking that they should give him, they should prepare for him to eat beets with mustard. V'chad have a shol b'ushpiza, also the same Rabbi Yossi bar Asyon, he used Lashon Chochma for another purpose to ask about an inn. To ask about an inn or about the innkeeper. He would say, Omar Hochi, Gvar Pum Dein Chai Mazu Toiva Yesh. So Rashi explains, the word ushpiza, we can break down like this. The ush is like the word ish, and the Aramaic word for that is gvar, man. Pum is the word peh, so p, so therefore you have ushpi so far. Dein is ze, so that's so there you have the word ushpiza. So then the question was, Chai, is he alive? Mazu tova yesh, how much good does he have? In other words, is he still alive, and is he still doing well? He would ask about his innkeeper or the person he boarded by or whatever. Tosfos brings a little bit different, that the Chai was actually part of the code as well. The word Chai can, besides meaning alive, can also mean raw, and therefore it represents the word the na of the word ushbizich na, which means the innkeeper. And then he would be asking, Mazu Tova Yesh, what good does he have? In other words, is it a good inn? Now, why would he have to use Lashon Chachma for that? Marsha says one thing is because when he's asking about the Ushpiza, part of it is also he's asking how the innkeeper's wife is doing. It's not derech eretz to openly to ask about for a man to ask how a woman is doing. So therefore, he would use this lashon chachma in order that other people, who it's none of their business, wouldn't understand what he's asking and wouldn't draw wrong conclusions from that about what men and women are allowed about men being allowed or not being allowed to ask about the health of a woman. Another explanation is also that we find in the Gemara above Matzia that if you praise a person who takes in boarders or an innkeeper or whatever, the problem is that then people are going to try to take advantage of him. Oh, he's such a good machnes erdach. Let's go and eat him out of house and home. So therefore, again, he would be using Lashon Chochma to ask about it, and this way the bystanders don't realize what he's asking and don't go. Yeah. That's one of the things that a Talmud Chacham is allowed to lie about, right? So we said the other day that Rabbah attributed a braisa to Rabbi Yossi, even though it wasn't actually from Rabbi Yossi. So you're asking, is that another example where Talmud Chacham can lie? I guess it must be. I mean, the Morgan Avram again brings on this that you can do that if you know that something is correct api halacha, but you know other people are not going to accept it from you unless you attribute it to somebody who you know that they'll accept his opinion. Then you're allowed to do that. It's interesting, by the way, you know, the Alter Rebbe often follows the Magen Avraham in his Pesachim, but you don't find this Psak Halacha anywhere in all of the Alter Rebbe's writings, not in Shulchan Aruch, not in Hilchos Talmud Torah, not in any of the expected places where you would expect to find it, as far as attributing something to somebody who didn't say it. So maybe the vote is, you know, we know how much the Alter Rebbe was into Midas Emes. You have the famous thing that it says that in Igeres Beis of Tanya, if he hadn't written the words Midas Emes the Yaakov, he could have had 50,000 more chassidim over the Rebbe Mont Emes. Maybe this is related to that. Maybe he couldn't bring himself to quote such a halacha, even if technically you're allowed to, because it's still a slight lack of Emes. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara. Rabbi Bohu kiyav mishtoi b'loshen chachma, when Rabbi Bohu wanted to use loshen chachma, he would say as follows. This is also where he's telling them what he wants to eat. He would say like this: Atrigu lepechamin, make the coals like a srogim, meaning set them on fire so they burn bright, and reddish and yellow like the color of an esrog. Alkiu lezahavin, spread out the golden ones, meaning the coals that are burning golden bright. And make for me two things that announce in the darkness, meaning two roosters, two chickens that crow in the nighttime and people know what time it is. Ikadamri, or some say the last words of it were Vayasuli Bahen Shne Magide Ba'alata. They should use these coals to prepare for me two roosters to eat. So again, Bepashtus, the idea is he doesn't want everybody else. It's not everybody else's business what he's having for lunch or dinner or whatever. So therefore, we use Lashon Chachma. The Chida in Pesach Einayim actually talks about, with this and with a number of the other things on this Amud, the Lashon Chachma, there were meant to be deeper meanings in it as well. And here he says that what it means is the word Atrigu, he says, is related to the word Tauyag, as in Tauyag mitzvahs. Pechamin, the coals means Rishoyim, who are black and unattractive like coal. So get the Rishoyim to do tshuva and keep 613 mitzvahs. Arkiu lezahavin, put your gold in the rakia, meaning give tzedakah, so you're storing up your gold in Shamayim rather than here on earth. Like you have the story of Munbaz HaMelech in Baba Basra, where he used all of his treasures, all of his royal treasures, and the ones that were from generations before to feed poor people, and his family complained to him, Aitachan, you're wasting the whole royal treasure. Explain to them that I'm storing up treasure in Shemayim. And then Va'asuli Shnema Gidibalata, and then the result of that will be that when it comes to the darkness after 120, there'll be two malachim speaking up on my behalf for the mitzvahs that I did. So this is he's giving people a program for life, work on getting the Rishoyim to do tshuva and to do mitzvahs, work on giving lots of tzedakah, and then you can be sure that you'll have Sanigurim, that you'll have defenders after 120. Amr le Rabbanan le Rabbi Bohu. So another example of Lashon Chachma. The Chachamim one time asked Rabbi Bohu, Hatzfinenu, inform us, Heichen Rabbi Loi Tzofun. Where is Rabbi Loi hidden? Rabbi Loi was regularly in the Beis Medrash, but now they haven't seen him around. So Hatzfinenu means show us. Rashi says, Lashon Sefiya Alichas Beisa. And where is he hiding? Because he's not in the Beis Medrash now. So they themselves are sort of using Lashon Chachma by using the word Hatzpinenu and Tzafun, which is what Mefarshim on the Pasuk call Lashon Nofel al Lashon, like one part of the expression that fits together with another part, the word Hatzpinenu and Tzafun. Amalahan, so he answers them, again using Lashon Chachma, Olatz, he rejoiced, Benara Aharonis, with a girl from the family of Aharon, meaning a wife that, well, we're going to see in a second two possibilities what it means. Aharonis, the last one. Ironis, a lively one. Vehin Iratu, and she kept him up all night. So what does this mean? Amrila Isha v'Amrila Masechta. One explanation is that Rabbi Bohu means that Rabbi Loi had just gotten remarried. His first wife passed away. He remarried a girl, a Baskoyan, so that's that Olatz, he was happy with her. Benar Aharonis, a girl from the family of Aharon, meaning a Baskoyan. Achronis, she was his second wife because his first one passed away. Ironis, she was a lively girl, so she had interesting conversation and all. Behiniratu, and therefore she kept him up all night, and therefore now he's sleeping in. The other possibility is that Rabbi Bohu meant that Rabbi Loi had just started a new Masechta, and that kept him up all night. Aharonis, Rashi says, would be from Seder Kodshim. Aharonis would be the most recent one that he started. Ironis means lively. It's a very deep, complicated Masechta. Vihiniratu, and therefore it was so interesting and so absorbing that it kept him up all night. Marshall says a little bit differently. If we say that it means a Masechta, Aharonis can mean a Masechta from Seder Taharos, because the Kohenim particularly have to stay Tahor, and Achronis, in the sense, it's the last one, because the last Seder of the Shisha Sidri Mishnah. Okay. Another example, Amri Leila Rabbi Loi, the same Chachamim one time asked Rabbi Loi, once he was back in the Beis Medrash, Hatzfinenu Heichan Rabbi Bohu Tzafun, show us or inform us where Rabbi Bohu is hiding, because he's not in the Beis Medrash. Amar lahen, he answers them, Nisya'i, also with Lashon Chochma, Nisya'etz b'machtu, he took advice from the one who crowns, meaning the Nasi, who has the ability to crown people with the title, with smicha, with the title of Rebbe, v'hingiv, and he went south, Lashon Negev, l'mifi boshes, to the great Chachamim who live in the south of Eretz Yisrael, in Eretz Yehuda, who are called mifi boshes. Mifi boshes was the name of Mephibosheth was the name of David's Rebbe, so therefore it's used as a nickname for tremendously great Talmid Chachamim. So in short, Rabbi Loi is telling them that he consulted with the Nasi, and he went south. He went to the south of Eretz Yisrael to learn from the Chachamim over there. Okay, more on Lashon Chochma, or more on learning something from what people say. Amr Rabbi Shua ben Chananya, mi yomai lo nitzchani odom chutz me isha tinek v'tinekes. Nobody ever beat me in an argument, says Rabbi Shua ben Chananya, besides for a woman, a boy, and a girl. Now, on the face of it, it sounds like he's priding himself, like nobody ever beat me in an argument. The Chidah says, actually, on the contrary, Rabbi Yeshua is telling us, I was always so successful in my arguments against the Goyim and against the emperors. We find in many places in Shas and Midrashim how Rabbi Yeshua had debates with Adrianus and with other emperors and prominent people, and everyone always bested them in the debate. And he's saying, even me, though, a woman was still able to best me in a debate. And the same thing, a boy and a girl. It's an expression of humility. He's the one who went to Chachmei Atona. He's the one, yeah. So yeah. So what was the story with the woman? Isha Maihi. Pam achas nitzarachti etzel achsanya achas. One time I stayed over by a certain inn, or I boarded by a certain place. Ostali poilin. So this woman prepared beans for me to eat. On the first day, I ate all of the beans. I didn't leave anything over. The second day, also, I ate it all and didn't leave anything over. On the third day, she oversalted them. On the third day, she burnt them with salt, meaning she oversalted them. So I tasted them, and I tasted there's too much salt in them. I pulled back my hands. I wasn't going to eat it. Amrali Rebbe mipnei ma ein chasoyed. She says, Rebbe, why aren't you eating? Amarti lo kvar sa'adti mibodim. So he doesn't want to say you oversalted the food. Doesn't want to insult her. I ate already. Amrali. So she says to me, if that's the case, if you ate earlier, hoyal chol limshich yodecha menapas, then you should have held your hands back from the bread. In other words, like this, you already ate the bread. Now it comes to the peas, you're not eating the beans, you're not eating them. So it's not because you already ate. There's a different reason. But you should know. I know you didn't want to insult me, but so you didn't want to insult my cooking. But why, Taka, did I oversalt the food? Omra li Rebbe, Shemala hinachta peya barishonim. is there may be a problem. You didn't leave over paya from the Udi ones. Now, we don't mean literally paya as in the halacha where you have to leave paya over from your field. We mean it was a matter of hilchas derech eretz that you're supposed to, you serve the food. In those days, the expectation was you leave a little bit of it over for the waiter to eat. It wasn't like nowadays, you know, nobody would ever eat and out of somebody else's leavings, but in those times, I guess they didn't care about that kind of thing. So therefore, so the vote was you... No, but Pashtos, the idea is that, well, they had drums, they just didn't know about them. it reminds me, actually, it says, when the Rebbe Rashab said the Maimer Hecholtzu, what was all about Avos Yisrael, and then how to fight against Sinas Yisrael and whatever. So what was the vote? There, at a Fabrengen, one of the Chassidim drank from a cup, and then he left it on the table for somebody else to drink, and another person did not want to drink from the same cup. So that, again, in those times, since they didn't know about drums, he's not concerned about drums. It's evidently he doesn't like the other guy enough to drink from his cup. So that led the Rebbe Rashab to deliver the Maimer Hecholtzu. So we see that there was this concept of eating and drinking from each other's leavings. Anyway, the point is that Hilchas Derech Eretz is you're supposed to leave some of the food over for the waiter, and Rabbi Yeshua didn't do that. So therefore, so V'loy kach omru chachamim, didn't the chachamim say, ein meshayrin peya be'ilpas, you don't leave over this peya in the pan, in other words, when you're serving the food, you don't have to leave anything over in the pot for the waiter, av meshayrin peya be'kara, but then when you, the guest, are eating, you're supposed to leave over a little bit for the waiter to eat afterwards, and you didn't do that, so therefore, like she's hinting to him gently, she over-salted the food in order to spark this whole discussion so that he should understand what the right thing is to do. So Taka, why didn't he leave any in the first place? So there's a few possibilities that Mefarshim talk about. He may have figured it's only Hilchos Derech Eretz and it's not something that's required. It might be that there's no waiter over here, she was serving him herself. So therefore he figured there's no issue with that. It might even be it was his own peas that he brought with him and he just gave it to her to cook. Whatever it is, she's still telling him that nevertheless, you're still supposed to leave over peya. So that's what Rabbi Yeshua is saying, that a woman once beat me in an argument in that she taught me this that I didn't know before. Tinoikas Maihi, what's the example of the girl that bested Rabbi Yeshua in an argument? Rabbi Yeshua says, one time I was walking on the road, the road passed through a field. I'm walking on this path. So a certain girl says to me, Rebbe, isn't this a field? What are you doing walking through it? So I said to her, isn't it a trodden down path? It's a path that many people before me have used. And even al pi halacha, you have a concept called Meitzer Shech Ziku Boi Rabim, also the Kalkala. If you have an area that Rabim have taken chazaka of it and are using it regularly, then you can't ruin it. You can't say, you know what, but it's my field, I want to plant it. So therefore, we're entitled to use it. Amrali listim kamecha kavshua. So she says to me, thieves like you are the ones who treaded it. In other words, it was never meant to be that it's for the rabbim. It was a private field over here, which is planted. People started walking through it, so eventually a path developed. Doesn't mean that you have the right to continue using it. And again, al pi halacha, when we say meitzer shech zikur b'rabbim, if they took possession of it completely illegally, then we don't necessarily say that also the kalkaloi. So that's what Rabbi Yeshua is saying, that she pointed out this to him, some of the mephoshim actually say, so what is she calling Rabbi Yeshua listim? What are you doing calling Rabbi Yeshua listim? The vote is, we learned before in the previous parak that sometimes the chachamim would be so fartifed in their learning that they're walking and don't even realize where they walked. We had the example of Reb Nechemia, who walked outside the Tchum on Shabbos, not even realizing, and they had to make a mechitza of people to allow him to come back in. So therefore, she's saying like this, you know, you have people like you who are fartifed in Torah and are walking around and don't realize where you're walking, but you know what? You still have to realize, you still have to stay out of people's property and not create a derech kvusha l'rabim, like that. Tinek Maihi, what's the example of the boy? One time I was walking on the road, I saw a boy sitting by a crossroads. So I asked him which direction, which road to take to the city. He says, this one is short but long, and this one is long but short. So I figured, okay, let me go on the short one, which is long. He says it's short. What does he mean long? I don't know. But okay, I'll go on the short one. Kivinchi Gatilai, when I reached the city, I found, yes, it's a shorter road. It reaches the city more directly. But Matsasi Shimakifanoisek Ganis Apaudesim, that road leads to all the gardens and orchards around the city, so there's no easy way to get through unless you go through people's property. And he just learned from the previous story not to do that. Chazarti l'achoreis, so I turned around, went back to the crossroads. Amarti loy, the boy is still sitting over there. So I said to him, Bni, haloy amarti l'ktsara. Didn't you tell me it's a short path? Amarli v'loy amarti l'charucha. And I also said it's long. You should have realized that ktsara v'arucha, al darach hakantanya, means it's a more direct way, but it's not going to actually reach you to your destination without a great deal of extra effort. Neshaktiv al Rosh, so Rabbi Yeshua says, I kissed him on the head. I said to him, Ashreichem Yisrael, how happy you Jewish people are. Shekulchem chachamim gdolim atim migdolchem v'adktanchem. All of you are great chachamim, from the greatest to the smallest, that even this little boy knows this dvar chachma, to know the difference between ktsara, to be able to express that difference between ktsara v'arucha versus arucha uktsara. You need the arucha sometimes, but eventually that will be the ktsara, because it'll actually get you to your destination, as opposed to the ktsara v'arucha may not actually reach you, get you all the way there, even though it seems on the face of it to be shorter. The Alter Rebbe doesn't bring the story in Tanya, but we know on the title page of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe says "Bederach Arucha Ktsara Bez Hashem," which means that in Tanya you have both. There's a Derech Ktsara V'Arucha. There's a short way to reach Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, but on the face of it, it's shorter. It's described in fewer Prakim of Tanya, but it's much longer. It's much more intense to actually reach that. Versus, you have the Arucha Ktsara. You have the long way around, which eventually it actually gets you to your destination if you stick to it. So the later prakim are the Arucha Ktsara, the earlier ones are the Ktsara of Arucha, yeah. Yeah.